Thanks, Sarah. Hey, good to see you guys. Obviously, I'll be really glad to be back in person next week, but this is sufficient for now, so thanks for doing it with us. Tonight, we're starting a new series, a new teaching series on the life of David. And the reason that we're doing that, I realize we might wonder why even, you know, what's the value in looking at the story of somebody like David. But the reason that we're looking at the story of David is not even so much because we're necessarily interested in David's story, but because we want to see God's story, God operating or at work within the story of David. So this isn't really a study where we're trying necessarily to look at the life of David, but I would more so say we're trying to look through the life of David and into the story and the work and the character of God. And that's significant because the more familiar that you are with the story and the work and the character of God, the more you're going to be able to perceive his presence in your own life, listen and respond to his voice, live according to his way, walk in his calling for your life, all those things. So ultimately, we're sort of just trying to learn from the past, right? Let the past speak so that we can encounter God in the present. So I hope that as we do unpack so much of the story of David, that we'll see through that, beyond that, into the story of what God is doing, who God is like, and what that would do in shaping our own lives here in the present time. So I want to give us an introduction, just kind of some background to set up the story of David that we're going to be walking in for the next 8 weeks. So as maybe most of you probably know, David was an ancestor of Jesus. This is why we say that Jesus is the son of David, or he's in the line of David. Other than Jesus, there's no other character in the Bible that has more written about them than the person of David. David has something like 60 chapters devoted to him in the Old Testament alone. So he's kind of a big deal, right? He's like a mountain on the landscape of the biblical geography, so to speak, right? David even wrote some of what would become the Bible itself. He authored numerous psalms. And David is the only person in the Bible, whole Bible, of whom it is said that he was a person after God's own heart, which is high praise, of course. And then in the memory and the imagination of Israel, David was kind of the embodiment of what a good king was supposed to be like. So in Psalm 68, verses 70 and 72, this is what it says about David. It says, God chose David, his servant, and took him from the sheep pens. From tending the sheep, he brought him to be the shepherd of his people, Jacob, of Israel, his inheritance. And David shepherded them with integrity of heart. With skillful hands, he led them. And that's not just bragging on himself. David didn't write that psalm, okay? But it is a kind of wonderful synopsis, right? If somebody said that about you at the end of your life, that you'd been chosen by God, brought to where you were, that you had integrity of heart, skillful hands, that would be a pretty remarkable thing to have been said about you, right? Integrity of heart, skillful hands. That's in leadership what we call character and craft. But here's the thing about that summary of David's life and leadership. It's not the whole story, right? And for those of you who may be anticipating where we'll go in the future as we look deeper into the story of David's life and leadership, you know that he's an incredibly complicated. He's got some real contradictions in his inner life. He's going to make some horrible decisions that have just terrible effects on his own family life and on the nation of Israel in the future. He's going to eventually lead Israel on a trajectory that's pretty chaotic for their future, to be honest. And so I want you to know that I'm not blind to the complexity of David's life and person and leadership and character. But more importantly, I want you to know the scriptures aren't blind to that either. While you have some phenomenal statements about the kind of person that David was, like I just read to you in Psalm 68, the scriptures are the very thing that also gives us all the tension that you find within the person of David. So I don't want to gloss over and look through rose-colored glasses at who David is. In fact, at the very end of this series, I'll do a message where we'll talk specifically about the legacy of David and how do we see him as a historical person and how God used him and all the tension within him. But tonight I want to more so start at the beginning, not the end of the story. So there will be a lot of just story to tell tonight, so bear with me as we go through a lot of narrative, both background and our kind of our first introduction to David. But there's so much to say just to set the scene for who this guy was and what God is up to as God is working through his life on the stage of history. So the story of David picks up in the land of Israel. It's after the time of Abraham, after the time of Moses and the Exodus from Egypt. This is after the time of Joshua and the conquest of Canaan. And this is after the time of the judges, these leaders of Israel, people like Samson, Gideon, Deborah. And so the story of David kind of begins with a guy named Samuel. And Samuel was a stellar guy. I mean, that's the basic way to say it. If there's any character in the Bible who seems to always or nearly always get it right, Samuel was one of those guys. Samuel was a prophet. He was the chief prophet in Israel. He was the leader of the whole nation at this time. He kind of functioned like a transitional leader between the days of the prophets and the days of the kings, which are about to commence. So Samuel is the chief prophet, the leader of God. He has this really important role. And one day toward the end of Samuel's life, this is what happens. I'm in 1 Samuel chapter 8, and I'll just read some snippets of 1 Samuel here before we get to our main text later in 1 Samuel 16. But 1 Samuel 8, verses 4 and 5, it says this. All the elders of Israel gathered together, and they came to Samuel at Ramah. They said to him, "You are old." Right? It's kind of rude. It's a rough way to start. And then they say, "Your sons do not follow your ways. Now appoint a king to lead us, such as all the other nations have." And so Samuel is understandably hurt by that, sort of offensive. But God tells Samuel, and I'm just paraphrasing here, the rest of chapter 8, God tells Samuel, "Don't worry about it, Samuel," right? "They're not rejecting you. Ultimately, they're rejecting me." So God says they've never been satisfied with me as their leader, not even since the days of Moses, right? Even from those days until now, they have resisted me. They've tried to be like all the other nations, and this is no different. So God's like, it's not you, it's me, kind of a thing to Samuel. So we got to understand something about the relationship of kings and people in those days. At that time period, there was an enormous connection between who the king was and who the people were. So strength of the king, strength of the nation. Character of the king, character of the nation. The king was the representative and the mediator of the people, the one who fought their battles. Right? As goes the king, so goes the kingdom. So Israel's looking around at the Philistines, the Amalekites, all these other people, and they see that they've got these big, strong, powerful guys who are their champions, their contenders, their kings. And Israel is a bit envious and they're embarrassed, right? You may know the situation when some guy says that he has a girlfriend, but you've never met her. And he's like, "Oh, we met at camp, but you know, she lives in a different state." And you're like, feeling a little skeptical about that. And he's like telling all his buddies, "Oh, she's not on social media," right? And so you're like, "I don't know if this is a real thing." You're feeling kind of sorry for him. Like, maybe this is a fictional person. This is kind of the situation that Israel finds themselves in, right? They're like, you know, talking to these other nations like, "No, we have a king. It's God. He's invisible." And Philistia and the Amalekites, all these other people, they're like, I don't really see it. And so Israel is living in this moment where they don't have the tangible product of power. Right? That's what they lack on the world stage. They lack the tangible product of power. They're tired of God as their representative, their mediator, and they want this tangible product of power. And I won't harp on this tangent too much or go down this rabbit trail, but this is so often the way that Christians engage with our culture today. We look and we see what other power brokers, what other nations, what other people have. And we want a king who's going to be strong, right? We want a king who's going to help us be a powerful, winning people, somebody to fight our battles for us, like character, maybe just somebody to help us win, right? So this is what Israel wants. This is what they see that the other nations have that they lack, tangible product of power. So God gives them Saul. And Saul is, he's said to be a head taller than everybody else. So he looks the part, he's the full picture, right? He's big, strong, the people like him as their champion. But if you fast forward to coronation day, right, the moment when Saul gets his crown, things get a little awkward, more than a little awkward, actually. Samuel essentially tells the people off, right? Like if you imagine, you know, American inauguration day and what that looks like, I mean, it's supposed to be a celebratory moment. And Samuel's like the keynote speaker, and he goes up and addresses all the people and rebukes them. And so you've got Saul over here, like waiting in the wings to put the crown on. And Samuel is just letting the people have it for demanding a king in the first place. Very awkward moment. And so as a sign of God's displeasure for what the people are doing in crowning a king, Samuel prays to God and he asks him, and he tells the people, watch what God's going to do. He's going to send thunder and lightning and rain. And then just like that, it happens. And there's this thunder and lightning. There's this rainstorm, right? I got to appreciate the humor of the Bible here. Samuel is quite literally raining on their parade, right? He's come to be a naysayer to this whole thing. And so this is what's happening. It's an awkward, depressing, anticlimactic situation. So the people apologize. They say, oh, we shouldn't have done that. We shouldn't have asked for the king, but God's still going to give him a king anyways. And then Samuel reminds them of how good God is, and then he concludes with these words. This is from 1 Samuel chapter 12. He says, be sure to fear the Lord and serve him faithfully with all your heart. Consider what great things he has done for you. And yet if you persist in doing evil, both you and your king will perish. So you look ahead from this moment of naming reality, this moment of decision. And what do you see? You see that the king and the people do not have a heart for God. Saul becomes concerned with his own image. He starts believing his own hype, and he becomes a leader not under God, but in place of God. And so things start to turn tragic for Saul, for his life, for his leadership. And there's two big incidents that result in Saul being rejected as king and David being anointed as the new king. The first of these is that Saul, out of fear and impatience, he takes the place of Samuel and he offers a sacrifice so that God will bless his army in battle. And Samuel, like, no sooner has Saul done this, but Samuel shows up on the scene in 1 Samuel chapter 13, and Samuel tells Saul this, now your kingdom will not endure. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart and appointed him ruler of his people because you have not kept the Lord's command. So that's strike one. Strike two. Later on, Saul is supposed to wipe out the Amalekites, and instead he keeps all their plunder, like halfway obedience, does half the thing and then keeps all their stuff because he's drawn to it. And Samuel again shows up and he rebukes Saul. And Saul says this time that he was led by fear of the people. He says, I was afraid of what the people would say if we didn't take all this stuff. It's too good to waste. And you see in Saul that at his character and his heart, he's led by a fear of man, not the fear of God that Samuel had called him to. So once again, Samuel rebukes him. 1 Samuel 15, you have rejected the word of the Lord, and the Lord has rejected you as king over Israel. And watch this scene. As Samuel turned to leave, Saul caught hold of the hem of his robe, and it tore. And Samuel said to him, the Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from you today and has given it to one of your neighbors, to one better than you. Now that is about as quick a synopsis as I can give of the rise and fall of Israel's first king, Saul. And hopefully you can see how the stage is being set for a new king, right? For David to rise to power, who will have the heart that Saul never did, right? Fear of God, not fear of man. And so after all that, right, let's meet David, okay? 1 Samuel chapter 16. I'm going to just start in verse 1 here. 1 Samuel 16. So the Lord said to Samuel, how long will you mourn for Saul, since I have rejected him as king over Israel? Fill your horn with oil and be on your way. I am sending you to Jesse of Bethlehem. I have chosen one of his sons to be king. But Samuel said, how can I go? If Saul hears about it, he will kill me. And the Lord said, take a cow with you and say, I have come to sacrifice to the Lord, which is true. invite Jesse to the sacrifice, and I will show you what to do. You are to anoint for me the one that I indicate." So verse 4, Samuel did what the Lord said. When he arrived in Bethlehem, the elders of the town trembled when they met him. Right? Because they don't know. Like, is this good news? Is this bad news? And so they ask him, "Do you come in peace?" And Samuel replied, "Yes, in peace. I've come to sacrifice to the Lord. Consecrate yourselves and come to the sacrifice with me." And then he consecrated Jesse and his sons and invited them to the sacrifice. When they arrived, Samuel saw Eliab and thought, "Surely the Lord's anointed stands here," right, "before the Lord." But the Lord said to Samuel, "Do not consider his appearance or his height, for I have rejected him. The Lord does not look at the things people look at. People look at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart." Now let's pause here, because this is maybe the key moment, right? Our starting place for understanding who David is and why he's described as a man after God's own heart, right? This is a moment that frames for us and puts into context the whole of David's life as it's perceived by God. So Samuel is looking at the outward appearance here. And it's not necessarily like a fault of Samuel. It's part of the limitation of being human, right? Eliab, he's like Saul. He's a big, strong guy. And he has the benefit of being the eldest. He's the oldest son. And so it's not necessarily that Samuel is, you know, doing something, you know, sinister. It's not a deep flaw, but it's part of the limitation of being human that we only have access to the externals, right? That's all we get. You and I, we can't look at the core of who a person is, right? Now, there is some wisdom in recognizing, right, as Jesus said, bad tree, bad fruit. Good tree, good fruit. So, of course, there's some continuity between who we are on the inside, what we do, how we live. But in essence, we can't truly ever know the condition of a person's soul. People keep secrets, right? Their inner life is concealed from our eyes, but not from the eyes, not from the sight of God. And so this human problem sometimes can lead us to make false assumptions about people. It can lead us into poor judgments of who people are. And then we can also work on developing the outward appearance, our reputation and our standing, rather than the inner substance of our lives and our hearts and our character, right? And so there's a famous example of this in political history of looking at outward appearance. The year is 1960, and Richard Nixon and John F. Kennedy are in the first presidential debate. And up until that time period in American history, there had never been a televised presidential debate, right? There'd been debates before, there had been politicians campaigning on TV, but there'd never been a televised debate before. And so it's Nixon versus JFK. And going into the debate, Nixon is leading in the polls. He's kind of the favorite to win the election at this point, at least by most of the polls. And so in this debate, though, Kennedy, he's younger. He's in better shape. Nixon had recently been let out of the hospital for a knee injury. Kennedy makes the decision to put on makeup last minute so that he won't sweat as much and so he'll be more, you know, look better on camera. Whereas Nixon, when he goes up on camera and during his time in the debate, he's sweating profusely. He doesn't wear any makeup. He's looking a little bit pale and thin because he's just gotten out of the hospital. And he also had chosen to wear this like really neutral light gray suit, which really well matched the backdrop of what the TV set was that night. So he kind of blends in and people thought that he looked kind of like ghostly or, you know, ill or something. Like, it was not a good image for somebody who was being seen by the American people who wanted to see somebody, right, who was a tangible product of power. Somebody who looked the part of what a president is supposed to look like. And furthermore, there was a clock for the candidates to see off screen that the viewers at home couldn't see. So Nixon kept like looking at this clock off screen and nobody knew at home what he was looking at. So he looked kind of like he was this shifty eyed, you know, character who couldn't focus on the moment. So he didn't have quite the poise the image that Kennedy had. And this is felt by the nation and felt by the people close to them too. Kennedy's running mate, who listened to the debate on the radio and didn't watch it on TV, Kennedy's running mate did that. He thought that Nixon had won the debate. But Nixon's running mate, who had watched it on TV, he said after the debate that Nixon had just lost them the election. And he was right, right? Most Americans who watched on TV the next day after the debate, polling revealed that Kennedy had taken the lead. And then Kennedy would go on to win that election by one of the narrowest margins in American presidential history. So the moral of the story is that man looks at the outward appearance. This is what we do. Tangible product of power. Show me what I want to see, right? This is in our nature. It's part of the limitation of being human. But God looks at the heart. So all of us, right, humanity, we are flying blind when it comes to the true nature of who a person is, when it comes to what the future holds for you and me and our calling and our vocation and what God's going to do in our lives. We're flying blind. None of us have the eyes to see that. Only God can see that. And so the only sensible way to live in a world where we all lack that sight, where we're all flying blind, is to lean into a sovereign God, right? To lean into a sovereign God who is providentially ordering our lives and our story toward his purposes and for the ultimate flourishing of the world. That's the only sensible way to live in a world where we can't see what's actually going on internally or out in the world around us. So let me keep going here. Verse 8. Jesse called Abinadab and had him pass in front of Samuel. But Samuel said, "The Lord has not chosen this one either." And Jesse then had Shammah pass by. But Samuel said, "Nor has the Lord chosen this one." And Jesse had 7 of his sons pass before Samuel. But Samuel said to him, "The Lord has not chosen these." And so he asked Jesse, are these all the sons you have?" And Jesse says, "There's still the youngest. He is tending the sheep." So pause here. You know what's about to happen, right? This is the moment, right? Arthur, you know, pulls Excalibur from the stone, right? Like this is the moment of like kingmaking and reversal of expectations, right? David's life is about to change forever. And David never could have imagined the path that his life would take. He's out in the field. He's a shepherd. This is not a glamorous, high-profile job. He's the youngest. He's not tall and strong, right? But his life is about to change. He was in the field working in obscurity. He's developing his skills. We'll see some more of that later on, how that comes into play. He's forming the substance of his soul. This is part of the goodness of working in obscurity, doing things that aren't for the approval of mankind, but just working in the sight of God and being content in that place to develop who you are on the inside. That's a formative time period in his life. And this is true for us as well, right? You may not have the slightest fantasy what direction your life will take. Some of y'all, like, you got no idea. College, I don't know. Job, I don't know. Marriage, I don't know. Like, just a series of question marks for your future. And that's true of all of us to some extent. But some of us, at different seasons of life, we feel that, like, very acutely. Like, that's a real, like, the uncertainty about my future. Where am I going? What am I doing? Who am I? What's going on? All that stuff. We feel it. You may be left out of the important parties. You might be the least regarded by your family, your peers. You may not look the part of greatness. But the first thing that's evident in the story of David is that these things are not barriers to being used by God. They're actually the conditions that God looks for in the people that he chooses to bring into places of influence. So the lesson for us in this, right, is that we got to learn to look and to live beyond the surface. To look for something deeper, to see the field, whatever that might be for you, as a place of contentment and development. Some of you guys, you're in a family dynamic that's strained or that's dysfunctional, right? Some of you, you're working at Chick-fil-A, you're working retail, you're mowing lawns, you're doing whatever, and you don't necessarily see, like, this is not my career path. What's this got to do with anything? What's this got to do with my dreams and ambitions in life? This is so tiresome, so toilsome. Some of you guys, you're like stuck in a class that you hate. You're in a group project with somebody and drives you crazy. And you're wondering, like, what is the point of this? Why am I here? What's going on? That's your field. That's a place where you are right now that you might not necessarily want to be. but that is formative for your heart and for your hands, for your character and your craft. And God wants to use that and shape that so that you can be somebody who is responsive when he calls you, as he leads you into life that he has providentially designed and planned for you. This is where David's at. He's in the field, right? And we'll see more again later on is how that shapes him, how God draws that out of him and further encounters he has in life. So let me finish this story here, the end of verse 11. Samuel said, "Send for him. We won't sit down till he arrives." So we sent for him and had him brought in. And he was glowing with health and he had a fine appearance and handsome features. And just to note here, like the sense of that is that he's youthful. He's young, right? It's not that he's looks the part of a king, right? Being the youngest, being smaller than his brothers, he didn't look the part. Any of those features are incidental to who he is and his character. So then the Lord said, "Rise and anoint him. This is the one." So Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the presence of his brothers. And from that day on, the Spirit of the Lord came powerfully upon David. So let me just close with this key question, because this is what it's all about, right? Ask yourself, in this story, who knows what's going on? Who's the character in the story that understands what's happening in the movements and the moments of these events that are unfolding, right? Samuel doesn't know. He's like, "Go to Bethlehem. All right, I'll go find Jesse of Bethlehem, whoever that is," right? Samuel's not in the know. The elders of Bethlehem, they don't know. They're like, "Samuel, why are you here? Are we about to get punished? What's the deal?" They don't know what's going on. Jesse doesn't know. He leaves David out in the field with the sheep. Jesse's not betting on David to be the next king of Israel, to replace Saul and step into this position of leadership and power. He doesn't even invite him to the party, right? You got to imagine that's a wound for David, right? And David himself doesn't know what's going on either. He's a last-minute invite. He's the late arrival to the party. He doesn't fit the part. He has no kingly qualifications or ambitions. So the whole narrative is a reversal of expectations, turning everything on its head. Everybody in the scene is just flying blind. That's the central theme of this whole narrative. But here's what I want us to see. God has orchestrated this moment according to his plan. He has set things up in his sovereign providence just for things to unfold in this way. He wants David in the field at the start of this thing. He wants to create this scene of, what's going on? This guy, really? He's making a point. He's teaching through the narrative here. And he's seen the true heart of David. He's going to use the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. He's going to use the weak things of the world to shame the powerful. And this is precisely who God is. We know this to be true most profoundly in the person of Jesus. Jesus is anointed not for glory, but for burial in his own life. A cross is his throne. Thorns are his crown. And so it's on account of God's infinite sovereign grace and providential love that we have been given Jesus, the King of Kings, when like so many in Israel and so many in our culture today, we are still always asking for a king such as all the other nations have. And so the question I just want to leave us with tonight is, will we keep seeking after kings who look the part, or will we receive the king that God has given us in the person of Jesus, his very self? So let me pray for us. Father God, I thank you so much for the gift of King Jesus. I thank you that you see us when we're toiling in places where we don't feel seen and known, where we don't feel important. I thank you that you have a plan for each of our lives. And I thank you that you have called us to faithfulness in small things and in great. I pray that throughout the course of this night and the rest of this series, that you would open our eyes to who you are, to your character, to your work, to your story, that we would learn better how to discern your voice, how to walk in your way, to live into our calling, and to see you as always present and active in history and in the present moment now. Lord, bless the time of conversation as students get into their groups. And may you use this time profitably for our souls. In your name, amen.